Hey, this is Aaron Carnes. We started this podcast in 2021 to promote my book, In Defense of Ska. Since then, the podcast has grown into its own thing. I've been working on an expanded second edition. I interviewed new people, edited every chapter, and there's a new final chapter, 30,000 new words. The expanded second edition of In Defense of Ska will be released on October 29th, 2024. Can you do something for me? Pre-order it right now at clashbooks.com under the Books tab. The more copies it sells in advance, the more it'll get people to support ska music. Thanks.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Consequence Podcast Network. Welcome to In Defense of Ska. We aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of the music. Ska deserves the respect genres like punk, hip-hop, and hardcore find among their listeners. Our host is renowned music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska, Aaron Carnes.
Our guest today is Suggs, the lead singer of iconic British ska and pop band Madness. The group formed in 1976 under the name The North London Invaders. They changed their name to Madness in 1979. Later that year, they scored their first hit with the song The Prince, a tribute to Prince Buster, the Jamaican ska pioneer whose song Madness had inspired their name. Madness mixed ska with a variety of elements, and throughout the course of their career scored 16 top 10 hits in the UK. In the US, they only had one, the 1982 pop song Our House. Madness remains a huge legacy act in England, but has a smaller, albeit loyal, audience in the US. They returned to the US in 2024 for the first time in years, with dates in select cities. One of those is the headliner of Punk Rock Bowling in Las Vegas. They also are celebrating the release of their 2023 album, Theater of the Absurd Presents C'est la Vie, which became their first number one album in the UK. We talk with Suggs to understand the group's relationship to ska, but also to gain a better understanding of their legacy in the US. And now joining me is my co-host, ska veteran musician Adam Davis of the bands Link 80 and Omnigon.
I mean, I'd say one of my earliest memories is singing along to My House in second grade. Madness is huge.
They are huge. And, you know, I'm excited. They're coming to our neck of the woods. They're coming to the Fox Theater in Oakland for two sold out dates. And they're also hitting Punk Rock Bowling as the headliner. To me, that seems like pretty good, pretty big shows. But Madness doesn't quite see these shows as big shows because of the kind of shows they play. In England, I mean, they're playing in front of tens of thousands of people in England.
Yeah, weren't you saying something about them having a festival?
Madstock, I think it's called. Yeah, I mean, they are a huge band in England.
Definitely.
Here, they're kind of viewed, even though they have a pretty big audience, they're kind of viewed more as like this cult band. And I think that they're sort of seen through the lens of how we take in certain British, you know, pieces of culture like Benny Hill or Monty Python. So it is kind of just more of a cult thing. Like people, like there's certain people here that really love it. And then a lot of people aren't aware of it.
Yeah. I'd say in the US people think of it kind of as something that happened as part of like the 80s new wave scene.
Sure. Yeah.
But Madness has kept going since.
As we see, like they released a new album and it's sold really well. So it's not like they're not a band in the past.
Yeah. Aaron, I think you'd agree. Madness is the biggest of the two-tone bands and they've maintained that popularity.
I would love to start with your new record. You released a record last year called Theater of the Absurd Presents C'est la Vie.
Yeah.
I think one of the most interesting things is that it hit number one in the UK, which would be your first time ever, right?
Yeah. Much to the surprise of all of us, yeah. And we actually had to look on the internet to think 13 fucking albums, and we've only just got the first number one. But it's been extraordinary. Yeah, I mean, I can't begin to explain why we are suddenly, you know, as potent as we were a long, long time ago. But yeah, it was an interesting process because we heard that we might be number one, and then Taylor Swift brought out a flipping album, and then Drake brought out an album. And so it's in a three-legged race now. So we're going towards the finishing line. And our record company, BMG, said, look, if we could just sell 1,000 more albums, you will. So they set up a stall in Camden Town Market, and we ended up selling our own records.
Wait, you guys physically were down there selling them yourselves?
I said, this is full circle. Yeah. It was 40 years ago that I was selling shit in Camden Market, and here I am again.
Yeah.
And it was just enough to push us over. And, yeah, I mean, it resonated. It's funny, you know, we've been on the news and everything, being number one. I mean, it's a miracle, really.
Yeah, beating out an artist like Taylor Swift or Drake.
Exactly.
At this point is pretty wild.
Taylor Swift was not out there selling her own records, by the way.
No.
Definitely not.
She wasn't. No, she wasn't. But I'm sure I saw Drake out of the corner of my eye in an ice cream.
So Martin Freeman, the actor Martin Freeman, does some stuff on the record. Now, I knew that he was a fan. I'm curious to hear the story of how you guys connected with him. I think, didn't he meet you at a record signing at some point?
Yeah. You remind me. It was really sad.
Yeah?
Before most concerts, we have people who won a competition or for charity or something. You know, you meet people and you sign records. And I didn't know at that point, but it was his mum and dad had won a competition to get a record signed. And he was there as a 13-year-old kid.
Oh.
And, of course, we didn't know at the time, but of course, he didn't need to have stood in a queue. But we got to know him over the years. He's a huge music fan, you know, really, really seriously into music. And we've just been friends with him for a long time.
Yeah, he's, I think most people know him. He was in the original Office. He's been in...
Or as Paul Weller calls him, The Hobbit.
Mm, yeah, that's right. The Hobbit, yeah. Yeah, all kinds of stuff. He's a great actor and huge Madness fan.
Very good actor. Very, very good actor. Yeah.
The tone of the new record is interesting because it's very theatrical. It's kind of got a dark vibe, sort of surreal, like kind of music hall elements, but melancholy.
Yeah.
Was there any thought behind sort of the tone of the record? Because it's a weird record. I would say, which is definitely what
it's a very weird
record. But I love it when artists, you know, who've been doing it for a while and are known for something, put out a weird record. I think that's the way to do it.
Yeah. I you know, there's a load of, you know, I mean, intellectual stuff you can talk about, but ultimately you get in a room with your friends and you make music. But what happened was, you know, we had the pandemic and COVID, and everyone knows how divisive and horrible that time was, and especially as a performer, because you couldn't, you know. My wife said, she said, performance Tourette's. I was singing to people at bus stops, so they were running away. They were going, no, that flipping bloke for Madness again. And we was talking, you know, but the worst communication, I think, is email, you know, and we were kind of falling out. I thought we're probably never going to speak again. But then we got in a room and we started to talk. And in fact, those contradictions, I think, sometimes become energy. You know, when you look at a lot of great records, they come from some kind of consternation or arguments, or, you know, whether you want to talk about Fleetwood Mac or Oasis or The Who or The Beatles or the what, you know, and it created a kind of creative energy, the fact that we weren't agreeing on anything.
Sure, yeah.
And I think that was the main thrust of what happened, you know, that we were all sort of slightly annoyed about things, which is unusual for us. And I think that sort of came out in a lot of the tunes, yeah, that not in a aggressive way, but in a kind of slightly, I mean, Yeah, it was Neil Tennant, funny enough, from the Pet Shop Boys. He used to be a journalist, and he used to like Madness. And I remember one time he said, I've always thought you have pathos. And I didn't know what that meant. My wife called me pathotic on a number of occasions. I think it was pathotic. But it's the mixture of happiness and sadness at the same time. And I think that's something that unconsciously we've always had. And I think that is on this record. It's probably more sad than happy, but there is that mixture, yeah.
I want to ask about the song Baby Burglar, because I understand that this is either a specifically true story or relates to a true story from your younger years.
Guideless baby burglar, where are you heading to?
Yeah, you know, we weren't, because we were sort of, in the pop world, we were sort of happy-go-lucky as far as the sort of intelligentsia were concerned, but we really weren't. We were really bad kids, you know, really bad. And now it relates to, Leo's saxophone player was always, you know, he was a burglar. It wasn't my sort of scene. But he broke into the house of this an artist called Lindsay DePaul. I don't know if she means anything in America. But he suddenly had this epiphany, and he thought, I shouldn't be doing this.
What do you know what caused that epiphany?
No, just being in the house and thinking, I shouldn't be here. And him and his mate, Bob Townsend, they got a box of, they had a bowl of cornflakes and sat there thinking, we shouldn't be. But yeah, so there was a lot of petty crime in our younger days. It's just the way it was, you know. But the song itself is about that. Yeah, it's about, you know, I'm not telling you what to do or how to be, but I have walked in those footsteps, and it's a path that don't lead you nowhere. I mean, without getting, you know, we've got a terrible problem in London at the moment with kids stabbing each other, and it's just about that, you know, slippery slope that one hopes you don't find yourself on, you know. And all our songs are never about telling you what to do. They're just experience, you know, from experience, and just from experience.
And that's something I've always really appreciated about Madness, is that the songs are stories. They have characters. They have time. They have, there's like a, there's a location usually that you can kind of, you can feel the location. Even if you've never been there, there's people in it that you get a sense of. They're great stories.
Yeah, I've always, you know, I mean, people write songs differently, you know. Mm-hmm. But I've always liked a narrative. I like a story, yeah. And, you know, for us, it was the Kinks, it was the Injury, and people who told stories, you know. And I think that's a very sophisticated and interesting way to express yourself, you know. I mean, I think I don't mind, you know, songs about, you know, shagging a bird and driving a car down the freeway and all that. That's all great, you know, rock and roll, Chuck Berry and all that. But no, Chuck Berry was a great storyteller, actually. That's unfair.
Yeah.
But I like a story. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
So you're coming to the US in the spring this year?
Oh, no, not again.
Oh, not again, no, yeah. This started before the pandemic, right? And
yeah.
And how long, when have you actually been in the US last in terms of a Madness tour?
I think 1949, just after the Second World War. Just after you won the war, I think we came over there. Yeah. Marshall Plan.
Victory lap.
We came over for the Marshall Plan. For crying out loud, we're skin. I don't know, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I can't remember. It's a long time though. Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to it, I've got to say. Yeah, We never really made it over there, but we've always had a good time. You know, you've been nice to us in sort of your own small, very, very small way.
Yeah, I think that, there's not as many Madness fans in the US as there are in the UK, but those of us who like Madness here really like Madness a lot.
I know. It's sad, isn't it? You know, just grow up.
So in 2021, you released a compilation called Our House, The Very Best of Madness. And this was only for the US, right? This was sort of a trying to put it out there, like there's more to Madness than just Our House. Was that kind of the thinking behind the compilation?
I don't know. Ask Gwen Stefani. She knows more about it than I do.
You played on, you were on Kimmel promoting it, I think, Jimmy Kimmel.
Was we?
Do not remember being on Kimmel.
Do you?
I mean, Karns, Aaron does.
I saw it, yeah.
Did it remotely. Yeah, we did it remotely. That's it.
Okay. I'd like to talk about Our House a little bit because it is the sort of the song that got popular in the US.
Yeah.
Brothers got tonight to keep you cotton around.
In the UK, I don't even know how many singles you've had in the UK. It's a lot. The US, it was Our House.
Yeah. A bit too late, though, wasn't it? It's a bit late, you know what I mean?
A bit late, yeah, yeah. Do you have any theories about why that song in particular hit in the US, or is it just as mysterious to you?
I've got absolutely no idea. Ask Gwen Stefani. No, but I'll tell you what. No, it was amazing because I remember at the time thinking, Our House, right? In the middle of our mm-hmm. street, should have been Our Apartment in the middle of our freeway. How the Americans got onto that, I don't know. But you liked it, which was great.
Yeah.
We did rip it off from what's his face? David Crosby, Stills, Nash, and the other one.
Okay.
Our house is a very, very, very nice house.
Oh, right.
Two cats in the yard. Life used to be so hard. Now everything is easy because of you. Anyway, I don't know. I mean, it's just a good pop song, isn't it? It was a very transcendent pop song. You know, the earlier stuff, you know, the One Step Beyonds and the Scar stuff, and it was a bit more rough and ready, and I don't think it really connected. But Our House, yeah, just had enough sort of, we put some strings on it. I think that's what did it.
Yeah, I can remember being second grade on the school bus singing Our House with
Jesus. When your hair was like something worth looking at. Look at that.
My hair was much shorter
than
Jesus
Christ, man. What's that meant to you?
I've still got it, so I feel like I should grow it out, right?
You must have been a kid. No, you must have been a kid, I'm saying. Young.
Yeah, I was in second grade singing Our House in the bus.
Lovely.
I was one of our friends of the show, Ted Leo. He. I asked him what, you know, he's a huge fan of Madness, what he would want to know. And he said Our House was really big for him. And the thing that he's curious about is the production, because the time you guys made that song was sort of a kind of the mid-80s. And people were doing a lot of weird production stuff that really doesn't hold up. But Our House holds up really well. It's got just a nice grit.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, you know, we started out pretty much as a ska band, you know, on two-tone. And then we decided that we just wanted to expand our horizons a bit because we were into all that, like I said, the Kinks and the Beatles. And then we met this great string arranger, David Bedford, who's dead now, unfortunately. But it's fun, you know, it's not funny, but it's, you don't realise how pivotal that was. That when you hear those strings, like a great movie arrangement or something. Do you know what I mean? It changed the whole dynamic of that song. The strings, I think. Yeah.
But I think the sound of the instruments are all recorded really well. And I think it's a little out of step from the 80s. Like, it doesn't sound like the 80s. It sounds sort of timeless. And I think that's what Ted was kind of commenting on.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, now, I remember, you know, because we'd come out of a very exciting process, which was the two-tone phenomenon, you know, the special selector and all that. Then we were going into, what, you know, pop, whatever you call. But, and I remember very specifically that New Romanticism come along, you know, with Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet and all that, which was great, you know, it was another scene. But it just felt like we was on the other side of the road, you know. They were having a party and we just had a pop balloon on a piece of string, you know. And that was it. But we always had our own identity, you know. We were friends from school and we never needed to feel like we were part of anything. But just trying to expand our musical horizons, you know, whether we did calypso or jazz or whatever, you know, we were trying to do something different every time.
You were able to get on Saturday Night Live, I think it was a year later. You played Our House and then you played Keep Moving, I think was the other song you played. I was kind of looking this up and I saw some interesting stuff about your Saturday Night Live experience. I'm curious if you remember. The host was George McGovern, who's a politician, but Clara Peller did a cameo. She was famous for doing the Wendy's Where's the Beef ads. And apparently she, like I saw photos of her hanging out with you guys and like she seemed to really take to you guys. I don't know if you remember hanging out with Clara Peller at Saturday Night Live. I know this is obscure, but I just really got fascinated by this when I was looking it up.
I'm too much of a gentleman to talk about that. Yeah. I mean, you know, the detail is all a bit vague now, but you know, things like that were you know, great moments in our lives. Of course, they were. You know, being on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
No, I can't remember her. No.
You can't remember her, though. Yeah.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Back to the early years, let's talk a little about that. I want to hear the story about how you joined the band, got fired, and then rejoined the band.
Well, I was quite a charismatic kid, you know, and we all were, you know. We were sort of famous before we even started, around where we lived.
Yeah.
And that was the sort of binding factor that's carried us through to this number one album. Today. But, we were kind of full of ourselves. I was full of myself. They were people that I knew from around and about. There was a gang called the Aldenham Glamour Boys, right? And they were very notorious. Notorious. Duran Duran. Notorious. Anyway, wild boys, wild boys, wild boys. And we were wild boys. And they were starting a band. Everyone was starting a band in them days. You know what I mean? Everyone had a beret, a Jack Kerouac book in their back pocket and a saxophone with no fucking mouthpiece. But it was only some people, and they started to take it seriously, these group of friends of mine. And I knew that. And they had a singer who left. And then just one day, I was coming out of the cinema. I'd seen American Graffiti. And I was singing Rock Around the Clock. And they said, do you want to be our singer? And I'd never thought about it before, but I did, and became the singer, North London Invaders. And then I was going to the football. We used to rehearse on a Saturday. I was going to the football, and I used to make excuses about my auntie's funeral and cat died and all that. And then one of the bands saw me on a program called Match of the Day, which was the highlights of the football, and there I was. And I got sacked. Yeah, I got sacked out of the band. So you want to hear the old story?
I want to hear an old story, yeah.
Okay, so I was reading the music paper. It was called Melody Maker, right? It was all the, and at the back was all the classified adverts for musicians. And then I saw an advert that said, semi-professional North London band seek professionally minded singer. And I looked at the bottom and it was Mike Barson and his phone number, the keyboard player from my band. So I phoned him up and I said, "Hello, I'm just inquiring about the job of singer for your band. What, out of interest, what's happened to the old one?" And they said, "We had to sack him because he was going at the football instead of coming to rehearsals." I said, "Oh, yeah." I said, "Mike, it's me, you bastard." "Listen, mate, sorry about that, but I tell you what, we could do with you back in the band." I said, "Oh, brilliant." He said, "Yeah, playing drums." I said, "Playing drums?" I said, "What's happened to John, the old drummer?" He said, "Oh, he's auditioning for singer." So I said, "You can stick it where the sun don't shine." Anyway, the next thing, there I am playing drums while they're auditioning for new singers. But they couldn't get one, so I got the job back.
How were you on drums, Suggs?
Terrible. Purposely terrible. Putting off these new singers.
Now, Madness has a lot of influences, ska and reggae being just one of those influences. What was all of your relationship to ska and reggae in those early days?
Good. You know, I mean, I was talking to a fella in a cab the other day whose dad was Tapazuki. He was a big reggae artist. We were talking about that. You know, when we grew up, you had Desmond Dekker, Toots and the Maid. You know, it was on the radio. You know, it was on the pop radio. You know, in America, you had gospel and R&B. You know, we had ska and reggae was part of the pop firmament. It wasn't something rarefied. But then it kind of went out a bit, and I remember I had friends who were really into rock and roll, like 50s rock and roll, Teddy Boys and all that, what we had here. And then they started to go back, you know, into like bluegrass. And the same way Bob Marley really sort of blew it apart when he came to England. And then we started to look back, you know, back to Rocksteady, back and back and back, and then back to Prince Buster and the Scatterlights. And so it was a kind of badge of something that you knew more about than somebody else. You know what I mean? It became our little kind of scene. And we had a pub, the Dublin Castle, and we'd had our own records on the jukebox, and we were getting more and more into the more obscure, into Mento, you know, into really obscure Jamaican music. And it was just something that it was like our thing, do you know what I mean? Like a badge of honour.
Yeah.
You know, punk was going on over there, which was great, but we were in our own little bubble. And then Specials come along, and then we realised there was other people into it, and Selector and all the rest of it, and Two Tone just blew up, you know. We were just in the right place at the right time.
So before you had crossed paths with the Specials, you weren't aware of any other band doing what you were doing, right? Just sort of mixing ska and reggae with other kind of styles of music going on at the time?
Very, very little. Ian Dury, ironically, had a band called Kilburn and the High Roads, and they were doing a little bit of kind of ska, but no, nobody else. I mean, there were a lot of great reggae bands around. You know, there was Steel Pulse, Aswad, Black Slate, you know, playing contemporary reggae, but there was nobody playing ska, which, I mean, it fitted because it had the energy of, you know, it was just coming out of punk, you know what I mean? The energy of punk.
Yeah.
And that up-tempo really suited the dance floor, you know. And so, well, the Specials, more than us, really mixed punk and ska. We were mixing ska with other elements of popular music. But that, you know, we just realised when we were playing gigs, if we played ska songs, the crowd would go mad. So we just got more and more into it.
So the band eventually, you call yourselves Madness. You cover the song Madness, which is a Prince Buster song. And you write the song The Prince, which is about Prince Buster. And One Step Beyond is also a Prince Buster song too, I believe.
Yeah.
I'm curious if you'd ever gotten the chance to meet Prince Buster. if you had, what that was like.
Well, there's three things there. One is that, yeah, and then we didn't want to put out One Step Beyond because we said we don't want to just be a Prince Buster flipping tribute band.
Yeah.
But thank God our record company, you know, beat us to it. But secondly, One Step Beyond was the B-side of Al Capone,
mm-hmm.
Prince Buster, which is what the Specials took for Gangsters. It's just a very bizarre parallel. And then the third thing is, only time I met Prince Buster is we split up. We hadn't played for 8 years. In 1992, we played this huge festival in North London. And our promoter said, there's a geezer outside with a beard and a trilby, which is a hat, saying he's Prince Buster. Shall we let him in? And I thought, well, even if he isn't, let him in. Yeah, if he says. And it was Prince Buster. And it's the first time you ever met him after all them years of what he'd given to us. His manager said he wants to come on and sing Madness with you at the end, but he wants 10 grand. I thought, well, after all we've made out of you, yeah, give him 10 grand, yeah. So that was it, yeah. I did meet Prince Buster, yeah.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Also sang with him on Later with Jules Holland. I don't know if you know that program.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah, look that up on YouTube. That's great, that. Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think. Enjoy yourself while you're still in the pink. What is your connection, chaps? What's your connection to?
We grew up together. Aaron was in the first ska band I ever really had a connection to. They were just a local band in town.
Nice one.
And then through them, I ended up joining that band and then joining a band in the East Bay. And then we've stayed friends ever since, and we both love ska.
So what year was that?
1993-ish.
Yeah.
We've met first in 92 at a Cure concert.
Right.
Yeah, so we grew up at a time where we were first learning about the music in the early 90s and then, you know, then going, learning all the bands happening and then going backwards.
Yeah, it's so funny because obviously it's like, for me, so, you know, that it was all done and dusted by then, do you know what I mean? For us.
Sure.
England. Yeah, yeah. I mean... It, and for you, it was just starting. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the beautiful thing about recorded music.
The earliest people I remember in America was the Boss Tones, wasn't it? The Boss Tones.
Mm-hmm.
There was Fishbone. Do you remember them? I used to like them.
Oh, yeah.
They were flipping great, they were. But, yeah, it was very... It never really took, did it, Scar? I mean, in that way in America, did it? It didn't sort of. I mean, the coast. I always remember the West Coast and the East Coast, but in the middle, it never really took hold, did it? Really?
No, they had some good bands on the underground scene.
Yeah,
yeah,
but never so much. It never really crossed over.
Like we're in the UK, you guys had it was top four. It was popular music, but it wasn't popular music in the US. It was kind of like. Cool.
No, because I've, you know, I mean, not like I say, but that very specific thing that obviously because of the colonialism of West Indies, you know, and Jamaica and mm-hmm. all that, we had, you know, we had this, you know, immigration of Jamaicans and then that infused, you know, I mean, your carnivals and you'd hear reggae, you know, I mean, everywhere you went when I was a kid, obviously it was a different thing in America. Yeah, yeah.
What were American crowds like for you guys when you were coming over?
Good, good, good. You know, but it's funny. I remember one time we went and we just put out a new album, but it was very eclectic.
Oh,
Mad Not Mad, it was called, yeah, in England.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd kind of sort of moved on a bit from pure ska, you know what I mean? We'd kind of gone up a bit more eclectic and we thought we'd play our new album. And I can't remember, San Francisco or somewhere. And they started sitting down and booing. They started chanting, play some ska, play some ska. And we suddenly realized that we were in a place that was 20 years, I mean, 10 years, you know what I mean, previous, what they thought of the band, because they'd missed out, because we hadn't been there for 10 years.
Yeah.
Whereas in England, we'd been slowly developing a new sort of, thing, and then realized that that's what they wanted to hear because it was something that you know, was new and fresh for them. You know, ska music was something new, you know, like punk or something. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's one of the weird things as a musician is that you, you know, you create this music, you record it, you spend all this time listening back to it, you go out and perform it for a while, and then maybe it becomes old to you, but then people, you know, people come across that music and it's brand new for them.
That's true, man. Like I said, this woman said to me yesterday, my son said, "Ooh, a madness." You know, and just because it's been in the news in England that we've got a number one album, he suddenly discovered it for the first time. Yeah, yeah, to him.
Yeah.
It's totally new, yeah. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because now, you know, you can look on YouTube and it's there, you know what I mean? When I was, you know, when we were young, it was really ephemeral. Do you know what I mean? It was a record, it was here and it was gone. Do you know what I mean? For 4 weeks and that record is gone and you'll never hear it again.
Yeah.
Now you can look up anything you want. You know, I mean, to buy a record when I was a kid, you know, you had to go to two stores, oh, we've sold out, you know, go to another store,
yeah,
find out who this band are, you know, get a music paper maybe, the Rolling Stone might say something about them. But now you've got everything at your disposal, which is great because a whole new generation, when we play live, I see so many young kids because they've been listening in the car to Spotify and they know all the songs, you know.
Yeah. It should
never have happened when I was young. You know, you were into a band and then they were gone and that was the end of it.
Oh, and the worst part was you'd buy a record and so you get the one record that you'd get of this band and then that became the band for you, just that one record. But then you didn't have enough money to get the back catalog. So you're just like, oh, I guess I'm stuck listening to this one. It's the one.
You only had enough money to buy one record. So you decide, you buy that one, you get the Clash album, I'll get that one, right? Because we can't afford to get them all.
Yeah.
And they come round your house, right? And you put the needle on the ground. They didn't know what it was, right? You hear the crackle.
Yeah.
Until the music started. And you'd all sit around listening to one record. But the other thing was as well, is it was your badge of identity. I remember Steve Harley just died, right? I don't know if you know Cockney Rebel. Do you know them? I don't think they were very big. Come up and see me and make me smile, right? First band I ever saw. And I remember going to school and you would take the album with you, right? You'd walk around the playground with this album because it was your identity, man. You know, you'd see some kid with a David Bowie album or a Bob Marley album. And you know, before social media, this is who you are, you know what I mean? Around with a fucking album like that. Oh, like as if you just like what are you doing walking around with an album?
You're lucky somebody didn't accidentally snap it in half.
No. I did do that once, yeah.
Oh, what record was it?
How do you know that story?
I don't know that story, that's why I'm asking. I know the one about you buying the Clash record and you and the person who you bought it with putting your initials on it. I read that in your book. Yeah. But I don't know the one about you snapping a record in half.
My manager, Katie, will tell you, right? My ill-fated career as a DJ, right? I got a slot, one of the smaller stages at Glastonbury.
Uh-huh.
And this is a big deal, right? And I think, yeah, of course, I know the fucking DJ. Put a few records on. So I put on Uptown Top Ranking, right? Do you know that?
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
See me in my pants and ting. And I had a really obscure version. And on the B-side was a dub version, which wasn't on all the main ones, right? So I decided when the record ended, I'm going to flip it over before they even notice, right, and play the dub side, right? But as I flipped it over, I snapped it in half.
Oh!
And now the needle is playing 40,000 decibels. And the geezer, when I came off, he went, "Suggs, you're a really good singer, but you are the worst DJ I've ever heard." And I'm not saying that was the end of my... I give it a couple more goes, but it went downhill from there.
Yeah. Was that the end of the set, or did you recover and put on another record?
No, I didn't recover from that. No.
It just turned into a noise performance.
Well, too embarrassing to go on about, really.
Yeah.
My DJ career.
Oh, since the Clash was brought up, I want to hear you have a great Clash story, don't you?
I come to the conclusion that when the band split up the first time, 1985 or something, it's because we'd run out of things to dress up as, because we used to dress up. Flowers, mushrooms,
yeah,
bloating traffic wardens. Anyway, policemen. So one time we got these really proper policemen's outfits, coppers, and discovered that the Clash were rehearsing around the corner. So we kicked the door in and went, "Nobody move, it's the pigs." It was just the sound of doors slamming and toilets flashing. And they never spoke to us for 5 fucking years.
That is, you know, I say that prank was worth it.
Yeah, that's a great prank.
That was shepherd's pie.
Yeah.
How is it?
Is your manager having shepherd pie?
Yes.
I love a good shepherd pie.
Man, right? Only when I've come around here, apart from speaking to you lovely girls, is that she said, "I've made a shepherd's pie, but an Indian shepherd's pie with a bit of curry." What were you saying, fellas?
Yeah.
Can you edit all
that sounds right.
Can you edit all of this out of the broadcast, please?
No, this stays in. This is the part we like to hear about. When you come to California, Suggs, what are you eating? Is there anything you're excited to eat?
Oh,
we got a lot of good Mexican food, man.
Oh, Mexican food. Chili con carne. Oh.
There's a good taco place right across the street from the Fox Theater.
Now, what was that? Oh, my God. There was a hotel, the Iroquois in L.A. Was it? No. Mm-hmm. I remember. At a black swimming pool. And around the corner was a pool bar, whatever you call it. And they did the chili con carne. And the breakfast as well. Yeah, breakfast in America. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's a winner, isn't it? Maybe a steak in New York. That one in New York where they're all stacked up in the window. Yeah. Heart attack on a plate, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can't beat a good steak.
What's your favorite food? Mexican. Yeah, that's great.
Oh, burritos for sure.
Yeah.
Mexican food. You guys are playing the Fox Theater in Oakland. There's a place called Zolo, X-O-L-O.
Yeah.
Right across the street. It's a decent taqueria. Yeah. Not my favorite, but it's, you could walk to it from the venue.
Okay, well, I'll check that.
Yeah.
It's diners, you know, like the old-fashioned diners. I do like a bit of that, yeah. Oh.
Yeah, there used to be one right downstairs that was owned by the bass player from Green Day. It was called Rudy's Can't Fail Cafe. No longer there.
No?
No, they shut that one. They still have one over, the next town over, next to where they make all the Pixar films.
Oh, right.
So, yeah. That one's still there, but the one in the Fox is gone.
That food porn, you get all these shows here. Matt writes food and all that, and he goes around all the worst diners. Oh, my God, it's so good, that food, yeah. A little bit more melted cheese on that, please. Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, you guys, there's got to be a chance for Madness to go to a Waffle House while you're out here.
Yeah, I mean, that's enough waffle, you know what I mean? I've had enough waffle for one day.
No more waffles.
Do you have a favorite pub and or fish and chips spot in where you're at?
Yeah.
Like a go-to spot?
Yeah, I'd say a load of pubs. The Dublin Castle where we started. But the French House in Soho is a lovely old pub. It's still proper. And then there's George's Fish and Chip Shop in Central Street. If you're in London, it's the best chip shop. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, yeah, fish and chips is still going. I mean, pie and mash used to be the thing, and they're kind of disappearing. Used to be these old sort of Victorian pies with nothing in them.
Yeah.
was an empty pastry bake with the, they used to call it liquor, which was basically boiled up eels. I don't know if you have eels in America. But
no.
It was a green sauce that you used to pour on this pie. And yeah, it was just a sort of, it was a rite of passage, whatever you call it, passage of rites, whichever way. But they've gone, the old pie and mash shops.
We'll be right back after this.
So I want to ask about the One Step Beyond is a song I've come to learn that's really traveled all over the world. I think some of that's because you had Chaz record a Spanish and an Italian intro.
Yeah. Un paso adelante.
Yeah, un paso adelante. I spoke to a journalist in Mexico who told me that that song was so popular in Mexico in the 80s that you would often hear it at a, what he called his sonidero parties, which is basically like a Mexican sound system where they'd play like tropical music, dance music. So you'd hear un paso adelante kind of mixed in with that.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
And the last time we went to the States, it was only because we got a gig in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it must have been that festival. It's like a huge dance festival. And it was 100,000 people. And that's what gave us the money to then not make any money in America. And we were going to do it again. But then the pandemic come and it's all gone cockeyed.
Yeah.
It was extraordinary. We were like a boy band, you know, it's like we were being mobbed just because of that one song, One Step Beyond. They really, really love it. Yeah, in Mexico, yeah.
What was the thought process?
What was the thought process? What?
I mean, how did you get the idea to sing? Well, we should also record a Spanish and Italian version. Did you? It just seems like such good foresight. To thinking that there would be value in recording other languages of the song.
Well, yeah, now I think about it. What happened was we had The Prince, which is a big hit in England, then One Step Beyond, which we didn't want to put out, but was then a huge hit in France. But what I remember is that there is no word for beyond in Italian, French, or Spanish. It's forward, you know, avanti. But there's no word for beyond. Isn't that bizarre?
Mm.
Yeah.
I was just laughing, going, well, what's the nearest word to beyond we can find? Adelante, avanti. And it was the foresight of our record company who that song was hitting it off, obviously, because it was an instrumental. It was like a sort of universal tune all over Europe to introduce it with something. So we tried to find words that were like beyond. Yeah.
When I was a kid, I would go to these church dances and they'd be playing mostly kind of modern rock stuff. But then there'd always be a pause in the middle of the DJ set and they would play One Step Beyond and that whole spoken intro would come on.
Yeah.
And there was a group of like mod kids at these dances that would like come out to the middle of the dance floor and the rest of this would be like, what's about to happen? And then the ska would kick in and they'd all start dancing. And it was like, that was my, like one of my first experiences, like seeing people skank at a show.
Yeah. That's funny you say that because the converse of that coin is that I get kids coming up to me and I had one yesterday said it was the most embarrassing day of my life. I was at a wedding. And they put one step, and my uncle started dancing. And all these fat old blokes start dancing like it was 1979. Like you have a heart attack.
What is it you guys call that train, Suggs?
The Nutty Train.
The Nutty Train. I love it.
Yeah, and these old blokes. And it's just, it's like a clarion call still, yeah, for that generation. Yeah. They just have to get up. And that's why we always start the set with it, because of that. Don't watch that, watch this, you know what I mean? And then you just know you're going to get the crowd in the right mood for the rest of the show. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It fills the dance floor immediately. So, Suggs, I used to play in a band that used to cover My Girl.
Yeah.
What can you tell me about that song? Because I've played it a lot, but I don't know anything about like who it's about or what it's about.
Oh, man. I tell you what. There's a great clip on YouTube. I don't know what it's called. But Mike, the keyboard player, wrote that song.
Uh-huh.
And it's about his ex-girlfriend. And she's on it. She's actually taken.
She's on the clip.
She's on the clip saying he just couldn't communicate, you know, only communicate through playing the piano. And it's just a great. He was saying that he was delivering bananas.
Hmm.
And he said the bloke who was driving used to keep going on about my girl's this and my girl's that and my girl's the other. And then we were in the studio with Clive Langer, our producer, and we got to the solo and he brought out a Thunderclap Newman song. Do you remember Thunderclap Newman? They had one song, fuck knows. Something in the Air Tonight? No, that's somebody else, isn't it?
That's Phil Collins.
That's Phil Collins. Thunderclap Newman. Anyway, the solo, it was like a real sort of as you go West Coast sort of rock song. Then it goes into this bit in the middle where it goes dun 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 dun. It all goes fucking discordant.
Yeah.
And he said, why don't you do that in the solo? And he did. Other thing I remember was I thought, Jesus Christ, this is a good song. B, it was the first time any girls turned up at our concert. We turned a huge corner, But it is a great song, yeah.
Yeah. For our version of it, for the solo, our trumpet player, his dad is a piano player, Paul Nagel. He plays in a Boz Scaggs and Bobby McFerrin's band. So he recorded the solo.
Right.
But I thought he did a great job of it.
Have you got it there?
Not with me right now, no, but I could send it to you. Yeah. The actual version is kind of a more like punk ska version, but the solo bit sounds pretty spot on, and then Paul Nagel's piano solo is pretty great. Something in the way she moves? Is that what you're singing?
Thunderclap Newman. Have you got Spotify there? Come on, look it up while we're talking.
Yeah, look it up, Adam.
All right, I'll look it
up. Come on, we've got to do that. Just for me.
Thunderclap Newman.
I mean, Jesus. Who can forget Thunderclap Newman?
Apparently us. Something in the Air.
That's what that the song? Did, didn't I? Something in the air. Come on. Come on, mate. Bit near to the mic. Here we go.
Oh, I know this song, yeah.
I mean, what a tune.
I've definitely heard this before, but I didn't know the name.
That song was in Almost Famous, actually.
And you know it's like feeling. But get to the solo, for Christ's sake.
Oh, yeah. Shit. How far in is the solo?
Well, you know, probably a minute and a half, normally, on a normal vocal player. Let's find it. Come on, hang on in here, right, guys. Look, I'm doing this for you.
Is this it?
No, not yet. Could be.
Sounds like it's winding up.
This is the Beatles bit, yeah, of course, yeah. Just hang on.
We're almost there.
It's like so instant these days, isn't it? No one can, no patience anymore. Go. There you go.
This is it, right?
There we go. My go. Oi! You got me. You get me.
Coming back.
I haven't seen, he's not, I don't see him.
I think this is one of my new favorite songs.
That's a good song.
Yeah.
Did you ever see Almost Famous, that film?
Yes. From,
yeah, that song's in there. It's like, I think it was in even in the trailer.
Right. Go on. Just one more question.
Oh, one more question. All right.
Can we hang out when you're in California?
Of course you can.
All right.
All right. That's not very good. I mean, that's a good question. I like the answer, but
not a great question.
Yeah, of course, man. Yeah, come to the gig and say hello. Yeah.
We would love
we'll
to.
We'll wave from the audience.
Well, I guess I'll give you one quick question. Maybe it's quick.
Go on.
The other big thing for the U.S. is dance craze. Now, that's how a lot of people came to learn of you and all the two-tone bands. I don't know that it had the same impact in the U.K. since you guys were already popular. But so I'm curious what that was like for you. And if you get a lot of people in the U.S. that said, like, oh, I saw dance craze. That's how I learned about you.
Yeah, you're right there. You're right. It's funny. It's also we did a comedy show called The Young Ones.
Oh, yeah, The Young Ones. Yeah. You play baggy trousers?
In Australia, it just went fucking mad. And all Australians talk about is The Young Ones. Yeah, Americans talking about dance craze, because it wasn't that big in England, because it was then, you know what I mean? It was happening at that time. You know, you could go and see those bands. You didn't need to go and to in the cinema. But they had a, I don't know, 15, 20-year reunion and showed the film. And I hadn't seen it for 20 years, and it was amazing, primarily because how young everybody was and how energetic it was. You know what I mean? At the time, you're in it. You're not really aware of how, you know, this is going to pan out over the time.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was really sensational to see it just for that reason, just how young everybody was. And, you know, when you see something that is what we call working class, I don't know, in America, you know, that hasn't been intellectualized, it's just come, maybe like hip hop, something like that. Do you know what I mean? It's just come from the poor people, and they've suddenly created something that's become more than we realized, you know, only when we look back. Because in England, the other thing about that was there was very little correlation between white and black people, you know what I mean? It was still very much, and then obviously it still is, you know, you still got institutionalized racism. But it was the first time that white and black kids were in bands together, were in the audience together. Do you know what I mean? Because up to that point, there had been disco, you know, was black people and gay people, and then rock was white people, you know, so it was very little. And suddenly, this explosion happened, and it was great to be involved in it. And then even greater to look back and see that there was a record of it. No, that's a great record of what happened. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, that live record, somebody just bought a copy of that for me for my birthday. And the energy listening to that soundtrack, it's a great record.
The energy, like I said, you know, I touched on that. Because it had just come after punk, you know, and punk was this incredible energy where suddenly, you know, music didn't have to be on some pedestal. You know, it was all be down on the floor with everybody else. And that's what happened, you know. Everyone come on stage and was dancing when we were playing those gigs, and all the bands came on together. But the energy, yeah, the energy, youthful energy was really terrific. Yeah, really amazing.
And I think one of the things is also just the sequencing on that album. Like, there's no gaps between the songs.
No gaps.
So it just goes one after the other.
That's the title of my new album. No fucking gaps, you know what I mean? Ain't got time for a gap. No, that's right. It was like that, though. That's the feeling, exactly what it was. It was just like, just relentlessly energetic, yeah. And what was great on that tour is because there's three bands, was Madness, Specials and Selector, and we used to rotate the bill. So, you know, we used to take it in turns. And then it would be like, who can outdo each other? And it was that, exactly, no gaps, you know what I mean? It was
Like,
you got to fucking do it every night, yeah, like relentless, yeah.
Kids in the U.S. who saw that film in the 80s, it was like they approached it like a concert. Like they would just dance in the theater, just dance on the seats, dance
right,
everywhere.
Yeah.
And I've heard from a few angry theater owners that that wasn't necessarily their favorite film to show because kids would get crazy.
Yeah, well, that was it, you know. And you look at that like when Bill Ailey came to London, the kids smashed the theatre up, you know, like excitement. When Motown came, they smashed the theatres up.
Yeah,
because, you know, when you hear great music, when you're enthused, you know, as a kid, you've got a lot of adrenaline, haven't you? And it can go either way. I mean, I remember we used to play some, and they go, everyone has to sit down. And they went, I said, look, mate, you can't, don't say that. Whatever you do not say that. But we were playing in a lot of old cinemas where they had all seats, you know, and then, of course, all the seats would get smashed up, yeah, and the place would go to pieces.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever. You all right then?
Who is this? This is my friend that grew up in California.
Bit of fun, isn't it? Right. That's how British people sound.
Yeah, good job.
Oh, God. That's not how British people sound. But if you want to hear what one of our favorite British people sound like, well, guess what? We didn't actually record any behind the curtain with this guy.
We have an extensive discussion.
We have a discussion about it. So,
because there are so many questions we didn't get to ask him, and I'm gonna give you a little sneak into my notes about stuff I learned.
Sneak into Aaron's mind's eye. It was funny because, you know, Aaron has these notes, and usually the guest follows right along with it. But in the case of Suggs, as you can tell from the interview, about 30 minutes in, he was kind of over us. He was just having a laugh, which is great.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I think really also just being able to see him on camera the whole time. Oh, man. He was having fun.
Yeah. So, you know, drop that $5 and come listen to us discuss this interview. You will not regret it.
You all right then?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.